This is KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. It's time for Issues and Ideas, a show that features a wide variety of local voices sharing their thoughts and perspectives. Today, we'll hear from two local authors who have written books about Hearst Castle architect Julia Morgan.
And when we consider that when she started San Simeon for W.R. Hearst in 1919, she couldn't vote in a presidential election, it's a reminder of how astonishing she was.
Also, we'll take a look at a Latinx mural project in Santa Barbara County.
And if we can include all of these cultures in our murals, people will have a better sense of pride in the community, more of a sense of connection to our community.
These stories and more coming up on Issues and Ideas. Good afternoon. It's Monday, July 25th. I'm Carol Tangeman. KCBX's Out of Reach is an in-depth series on Santa Barbara County's housing crisis. Beth Thornton reports.
There's a lot of summer activity in downtown Santa Barbara today, and that's true at the cheese shop where I've come to talk with the owners.
She's going to help on the counter. Sorry. We're a little short-staffed.
Michael Graham has lived in Santa Barbara with his wife and business partner, Catherine, for 19 years. Owning a home in Santa Barbara has long been a dream of the Grahams. But after many years of watching prices go up and up, they've put the dream on hold.
Definitely, housing has been a challenge. The goal always has been to own a home here, but the prices have been a little bit out of our reach.
In addition to soaring home prices, natural disasters like the area's massive 2017 Thomas fire and then COVID-19 affected their business. So the couple says it's been tough to get ahead in Santa Barbara. Catherine says they're not the only ones frustrated by the impossible housing crisis.
We've had a countless number of good friends that have opted to leave Santa Barbara because they want to start families. It's just not cost effective to live here in town.
She says she sometimes thinks about moving too.
We are constantly weighing that, especially in light of the fact that not only as the owners of this business, we can't afford to get into this market, but you know, our staff too cannot afford to live here.
Catherine says the high cost of rent and lack of available housing makes it hard to find employees. She recently purchased an Amtrak train pass for an employee who moved back home with her parents in Ventura County, about an hour away.
This is a great staff person, fully trained, and so we really wanted to find a way to at least keep her around for the summer, because it's taking on average at least 2 months for us to find new people.
Stories like this are commonplace in Santa Barbara these days. As we reported in an earlier segment on Out of Reach, local workers spend a lot of time commuting to Santa Barbara. Bob Walsmith Jr., this year's president of the Santa Barbara Association of Realtors, says it's been a challenge for people looking to buy homes. There's been limited inventory, he says, but he thinks the market is beginning to change.
We were living in a seller's market for quite a long time, and that's definitely shifting, especially in the last, I'd say, month or so.
But local economists do not expect home prices in Santa Barbara to drop drastically, which means the median home price will likely remain over $1 million. Walsmith says finding a place to rent is incredibly difficult right now, too. He regularly fields phone calls from people seeking advice.
It's almost impossible to find rentals now. The apartment occupancy rate in our area is approaching 99%.
The price of rent in Santa Barbara is up 24% in the last year, according to Apartments.com, and there are almost no vacancies. Rob Fredericks, executive director of the Housing Authority of the City of Santa Barbara, says the average rent for a one-bedroom apartment is about $2,500 per month.
Renters are being absolutely crushed right now.
Fredericks says the Housing Authority provides rental assistance for low-income earners, and they also build workforce housing for what he calls the missing middle. That's a term for households that don't qualify for low-income housing, but also can't afford current market rates.
They're professional working households that even at the income up to 120% area median income, they cannot afford the rents that are here.
He says the city is making it easier to develop workforce housing downtown by adjusting parking requirements and prioritizing areas that are walkable and close to public transportation. He says downtown housing can reduce the need for cars and help revitalize local businesses. One Housing Authority project coming soon will transform an underutilized parking lot on West Carrillo Street into moderate income workforce housing.
frankly, something that's so needed along State Street and along the two outer blocks of State Street is residential housing to bring that vibrancy back to downtown.
Back at the cheese shop, Michael Graham says he's eager to hear what the city has planned for housing at all income levels, including the missing middle. He says he loves Santa Barbara, but the housing problems need immediate attention so current residents can afford to live and work here.
You don't plan for it or don't make decisions or just try to keep things how they've quote-unquote always been, I don't see that working out very well for the community at all.
Our next segment of Out of Reach examines how the housing crisis is changing the historically working-class neighborhoods of Santa Barbara. For KCBX, I'm Beth Thornton.
The special report is made possible by a grant from the Sunflower Foundation. Julia Morgan, Hearst Castle's renowned architect, is the subject of two new books by local authors. KCBX's Benjamin Perper spoke with them about Morgan's life and work.
Can you both introduce yourself for me, please? And I'll start with Gordon.
My name is Gordon Fugley. I'm an independent curator, an art historian. Most of my career has been spent in Southern California and Los Angeles, but I've been in the North County since 2008, and I've been involved with a number of projects, and this is probably the most ambitious so far.
I'm Victoria Kastner, and I was the longtime official historian at Hearst Castle, and I'm the author of the definitive trilogy on its history, published by Abrams Books. And my most recent work is a new biography showing Julia Morgan's private life for the first time. It's called Julia Morgan, An Intimate Biography of the Trailblazing Architect. And I quoted from hundreds of letters that she exchanged with her family and friends. She exchanged 2,462 letters with William Randolph Hearst, the letters and telegrams alone, and also from five of her diaries, and the most revealing of which was the final one, which has never been in print before. So it really reveals her private thoughts and personal life.
So, Gordon, can you tell me a little bit about your book? I understand it's kind of a collection of your work and some others' work, right?
Yes. It is the work of seven scholars. And when I began this project in 2017, the book was designed to be the exhibition catalog for a show of Julia Morgan's architectural drawings, which, believe it or not, have never been exhibited in an art museum. And through the changes and chances of the museum world plus COVID, the book morphed and evolved. I would categorize it as the world of Julia Morgan. So it's not just about her, but also the architectural period in which she lived, the cultural streams and currents that influenced her and her colleagues, and why this group of architects, all educated in the École des Beaux-Arts school in Paris, how they were making an architecture they thought would define California at this crucial moment when California was entering the modern era. So I'll give you a rundown of the historians. In addition to myself and Victoria, who has an essay in it, two of them graduated from Cal Poly. That's Johanna Kahn and Jeffrey Tillman. They're both architectural historians. Other contributors include Dr. Karen McNeil, Dr. Kirby Brown, and Dr. Elizabeth McMillian.
Great. Okay, Victoria, could you kind of summarize briefly? And I know it's hard to do briefly because she was such a complex and interesting figure, but can you tell me more about who Julia Morgan was, her personality, and her work and her legacy?
2022 is Julia Morgan's sesquicentennial year. She was born on January 20th of 1872, and it's an important anniversary for both my book and Gordon's book to be coming out at that time. But more than that, it really puts in perspective how astonishingly ahead of her time she was. And she was not the first woman to study civil engineering at Cal Berkeley, which is where she did study, but she was the first woman to use that degree professionally. She was the first woman to go to Paris and be admitted to and graduate from with a certificate, the École des Beaux-Arts, the School of Fine Arts. And that is handled very informatively in Gordon's book. And then she was the first woman on her return to California to be a licensed architect. But more than that, I mean, she designed 700 buildings throughout her career. And when we consider that San Simeon was only given one number, 503, and that it has 110,000 square feet of enclosed floor space and 160 rooms and acres upon acres of gardens, shows how remarkable she was. Actually, there are very few American architects in history who have built on the same palatial scale as she did. And when we consider the two that would really qualify would be both on the East Coast, Stanford White and Richard Morris Hunt, both of whom were quite a bit older than she was. But when we consider that when she started Job 503, San Simeon for W.R. Hearst in 1919, she couldn't vote in a presidential election. It's a reminder of how astonishing she was.
Gordon, can you talk about her architecture style, especially as it relates to Hearst Castle?
Well, it's one thing to be educated at the Ecole and then have to come to the raw West Coast. There's a world of difference between Paris and San Francisco at that time. So it meant that all these architects, while they were looking to use a classical style, that they also had to adapt to the California environment, the milieu. You know, there's a lot of thinking going on in the 1890s and up through the 1920s about, well, what is American architecture? And many thinkers were saying, we should take the inheritance of Europe and make it our own. In California, which was far removed from New York, Chicago, Boston, etc., that would be a Mediterranean style of the École des Beaux-Arts. And with also a nod towards the mission style. And so you get an eclecticism among the architects that were proposing commissions, such as Albert Pieces, Bernard Maybeck, John Galen Howard, Arthur Brown Jr., and of course, Julia Morgan.
Victoria, what was she like as a person, her personality and her treatment of other people?
One of her employees in her San Francisco architecture office described her, and he said, a small woman. And then he said, gentle yet formidable. And that might be the best three-word description. She said, a low, clear voice, a direct gaze. She never raised her voice, but I've seen grown men tremble when she said, no, it won't do. So it's fascinating that she had really only soft power. She was about 5'2", stretching it, you know, charitably. And she was invariably the only woman on just about every construction site that she inspected. And yet she had this tremendous presence and personality and power. And she was a very, very respected by her colleagues. One of her, what turned out to be closest friends and early hires, a man named Walter Stahlberg, was looking for work in San Francisco in 1910. And he was told at A. Page Brown's office, who did the California building about which Gordon was just talking, the World's Fair. He was told, well, Miss Morgan is hiring. And Walter said, I guess my face fell at the idea of working for a woman. But I was told, listen, you'll get a better architectural education from her than you would from anyone else. And he turned up at Julia Morgan's office and she hired him. And on the third day, he came to work early. Her office was at 465 California in the financial district of San Francisco. It was a 13-story building. And he came upstairs to find Julia Morgan covered with plaster dust and climbing back in from the window. And she said to Walter, you have to go outside. You must see these soffits. It's so exciting. He said, well, there was no scaffolding. There were a couple of boards with some chicken wire on them, 13 stories above the financial district. He said, all I wanted to do was lie down and yell. And then he said, she was one of the bravest people I ever knew.
Sounded like she commanded a lot of respect even during that period, and even from her staff, like at Hearst Castle, right?
She was very much respected by her staff, and she was a very generous employer. In good years, she would divide the profits that her office made among the staff, do profit sharing. She really never cared about money, and she loved their children and treated them almost like her own nephews and nieces. But she definitely wanted her work to be done, you know, in a meticulous way. And she definitely wanted to have an overview, a control. Lots of architects of her era would assign an employee to another client, and then it sort of became their job. Never Julia Morgan. She was always on top of things. She hired men and women in almost equal numbers, never wanted to be a firm that was primarily hiring women. And one of the women, Dorothy Wormser Koblenz, who worked for her as a draftswoman for some years, said that she'd been working on a project. And when they got to the site, it wouldn't fit on the lot. And Miss Morgan came in ready to give me Hail Columbia. And I fished out the little sketch that she had given me to follow. And the numbers were wrong. And she said, oh, yes, it was entirely her fault. And then Dorothy concluded, she was a lovely person if you weren't being scolded.
So, Gordon, one of the subheads of your book here is Visionary Architect of the California Renaissance. How does Julia Morgan fit into that? And how does Hearst Castle fit into the California Renaissance? Well,
we need to talk about a few more buildings other than Hearst Castle, which, of course, it's part of it. But there's a cultural phenomenon in the United States called the American Renaissance. It runs from 1876 up into the early 1920s. And this was, again, part of that. Let's take from the best of Europe and adapt it to the United States to create this new democratic but heroic culture drawing on classicism. Now, in Morgan's case, so she's now in California, is she going to get an opportunity to use some of that French theory in the state? As it turned out, she did. And in 1915, largely thanks to William Randolph Hearst's mother, Phoebe Apperson Hearst, who was a promoter of the YWCAs, she was commissioned to design the Oakland YWCA. And in this wonderful essay in our book by Johanna Kahn, she shows that it is an very close adaptation of the Italian Renaissance architect Leon Battista Alberti's Palazzo Medici. Very close to it, and that's the heart of the Italian Renaissance. Now, she also would, down in Los Angeles, again, another, this is W.R. Hearst's commission, design the Los Angeles Examiner, later known as the LA Herald Examiner. And that building is in a sort of Spanish colonial style, also drawn from the expositions that were held in the United States. So it's kind of like a World's Fair style fantasy building. And then there's the wonderful neo-medieval building, the Chapel of the Chimes. And I think Victoria covers that in her biography. So she was able to take a number of, and the key word here is historicist styles, and adapt them to the needs of California in the early 20th century.
So it sounds like she and her architecture style and influence was important in the formation of that period in history, maybe in this area too?
Well, she did do the a more domesticated arts and crafts style of the Monday Club here in town. That is one of Julia Morgan's works. But here's the issue. The American Renaissance style of historicism began to fall out of favor after World War I, and this was replaced by those purity-oriented modernist architects who disliked historicism and ornament and all these elements. They thought form only follows function, and therefore it's the function that determines what a building would look like. Eventually, you get these streamlined glass and steel buildings. And as they were advancing their cause, they disparaged the previous architecture that came out of the American Renaissance, especially anything by the École des Beaux-Arts.
You're listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX Public Radio. KCBX's Benjamin Perper is speaking with Gordon Fugley, author of Julia Morgan, The Road to San Simeon, Visionary Architect of the California Renaissance, and with Victoria Kastner, who wrote Julia Morgan, An Intimate Biography of the Trailblazing Architect.
She and Hearst were both coming from San Francisco.
We're not exactly sure where Julia Morgan and William Randolph Hearst met, but as Gordon said, they were introduced by his mother, Phoebe Apperson Hearst, in California, either at the University of California's Greek Theater dedication, where Julia was the construction superintendent and Hearst was the donor of the funds for that massive Greek theater, or the estate that he started building and then Phoebe ended up living in the south of Oakland, called the Hacienda del Pozo de Verona, the House of the Wellhead of Verona in Pleasanton. So they had that glue. His mother had brought them together. His mother had asked Julia, whom she met in Paris via Bernard Maybeck, if she could finance her education. Phoebe had so many students that she was funding generously. And Julia said, no, your faith is enough of a gift to me. But she did stay very, very close friends with her. And when Phoebe was near dying in the influenza epidemic, she died in April of 1919, Julia wrote her a goodbye letter saying, your faith in me and my mother's faith in me are the two greatest gifts I have. And I hope you know how much I love and thank you for it. So I think that was the glue that held them together. The other thing that held them together was they both were native Californians and extremely proud of it. Julia said she felt very fortunate to be born in the place where she worked as an architect, because the other architects in California of that era were not native to the state. They were either New Yorkers like John Galen Howard and Bernard Maybeck, or they were Midwesterners like Charles and Henry Green, but she was a native Californian. She grew to love San Simeon. She was ambivalent about it at times because it did become so large. When W.R. first came to her and asked her to build it, he said that he was tired of camping and getting a little old for tents, and he wanted something on the hill at San Simeon. And so he was talking about a single bungalow, just regular style house that would take less than 6 months to build. And as Walter Stahlberg said, and within a month, they were going on the grand scale. So the construction went on from 1919 to 1947 with only one stoppage during the Second World War. And so even if he wasn't there, because often he wasn't, he had many other houses and businesses around the country. And she didn't live there, and she almost never spent the night. She would spend the night on the train coming down from San Francisco on Saturday night, spending all day Sunday at San Simeon, and then going back north on the train on Sunday night. So it was rare when she actually slept over. But nevertheless, she made 568 trips to San Simeon, which is an enormously long train ride, you know. So she grew to love it. And if W.R. couldn't be there, she could write him about the sunset that was blue beyond imagining, or the alligator pears, which is what they called avocados, that had just become ripe. You know, she was like the on-site reporter. And the two of them together were, as Walter Stahlberg said, long-distance dreamers. They really loved European art and architecture. They really loved the California landscape, and they fused those two things together at San Simeon.
Yeah, Gordon.
Yeah, I'd like to add to that, that the opportunities that William Randolph Hearst and Julia Morgan saw in creating and realizing these new buildings is evident throughout their collaboration. And in researching Hearst Castle itself, La Cuesta Encantada, I realized that what they had created, and this I got this largely from Victoria's essay, it's a recreation of a Spanish Renaissance hill town supplemented by two elements from the Greco-Roman world, the classical world. That's the outdoor Neptune pool and then the indoor Roman pool with its dazzling mosaic decoration. So it's, some people I've encountered who have discussed it have said, you know, maybe this is the beginning of postmodern architecture, where you're doing a fusion and a combination of all kinds of things, but making it work as a unit.
So one more question about Julia herself. Victoria, can you speak to how, maybe personally, how large Hearst Castle project was in her life? I mean, that was 28 years of her life, right? And was she working on other things?
The astonishing thing is that she designed some of her greatest other buildings in the Bay Area, particularly in those same years. And then she also designed an equivalently fantastical estate for William Randolph Hearst in Northern California, almost as large and still private, known as Wintoon, that's in a Bavarian style. So it is amazing all that she got done. When I first came to Hearst Castle on a tour, I was told, well, a woman built this, but we didn't know anything about her. And for the longest time, there were two long-held myths, and one was that she had burned all her papers, and we would never know about her private life. I think that probably came about because when she closed down her San Francisco office in 1950, she got in touch with her clients and asked them if they wanted to keep their drawings. She wasn't going to be able to store them. But actually, she saved enormous amounts of material from her childhood, from her parents, from her trips, you know, and actually, my research assistant, Ruth Latson, and I, our job has been to transcribe it, and we're proofreading it now, but we're going to post it online so that anyone from anywhere is going to be able to study the archives of Julia Morgan, which are local. They're at Cal Poly San Luis Obispo at the Robert E. Kennedy Library Special Collections. That's where her primary collection is. And to tell you how vast it is, our transcriptions are 800,000 words. So it is an enormous archive, so large that it's, I think, difficult to search through, but that will be easier now that it'll be word searchable. The other myth about her is that she was a lesbian. And I think that's because people have looked at her private life and thought, well, she didn't marry. In all those 800,000 words and in dozens of interviews with her family, friends, and staff, there's no indication of her having had a romantic relationship with anyone. And really, with the amount of things she was doing and the amount of care that she was giving to several members of her family who had lingering and difficult illnesses resulting in death, that took up all her time. But really, her romance was with architecture. And in the first third of the 20th century, if you were a career woman, and there she wasn't the only one, and she also wasn't the only woman architect, but you really had to give it pretty much everything. And it was her life that she called it to WR once, playing at work. And that's how she felt about it. She loved what she did, and she was enormously creative.
So Gordon, I have these two books here, and they seem like culminations of so much work and so much research and effort. What's next for you?
I don't know what will be next for me, but I'm hoping that as both of our books begin to be critically reviewed and enjoyed by people interested in Julia Morgan and in California architecture, that they will also reevaluate their assessment of this period. As Victoria and I both have mentioned, it became disparaged, looked down upon. It was, it was this unfortunate interregnum between what came before and then the triumph of modernism. But if you look closely and carefully at the ideals and the ideas that informed this architecture, not just Morgan's, but her colleagues, I mean, it is a way to see how the historical past and the greatness that we see in it still can speak to us today. And we overlook it at our peril because the past is never past, as William Faulkner once said.
Thank you. What about you, Victoria?
I'm looking forward to this part, which I love the most about being an author, and that is having written, talking about the book, meeting people, doing a limited amount of traveling and an awful lot of lecturing. But there is a great deal more to share. I really feel that we just skimmed the surface, and it is an interesting thing to change people's appreciation. I think they know it's significant, but they're not sure why. And when we consider that Hearst Castle was made by people who had nothing but a straight edge and a T-square, that they're doing all the drawings full size, that she was running crews of as many as 90 construction workers on site, and then had this whole team of artisans working mostly in the San Francisco Bay Area, whose work she also inspected because she was running her office during the week, you know. So there's a great deal more to discover and to share about Julia Morgan, and I'm eager to do so.
Gordon?
Yeah, I'd like to add that I consider Victoria's and the team's, team of colleagues' contribution, that is our book, both of them to be the second generation of a Morgan and scholarship on California architecture in this period. I'm looking forward to see what the third generation will produce, because there is much more to consider and interpret and make known.
It seems like she's getting a lot more, in recent years, recognition and appreciation, right? Wasn't she honored by the Association of Architects a couple years ago?
It's the American Institute of Architects. And yes, I was one of the people, we had a small committee of people who created essays that were part of the nomination to the American Institute of Architects to argue that she should be given their highest honor, the gold medal. But I must say, even when I did it, I didn't have a lot of hope that that would happen. And one reason why is because she had an aversion to being interviewed. She said the building should speak. You know, she didn't teach architecture. She didn't write articles about it. She didn't publish her work in magazines except on one small, instance. She just wanted to do it, you know. So she was not tending a legacy. And so I think that that was part of the misunderstanding. But yes, the appreciation has grown, and several great architects of our time, Denise Scott Brown, Michael Graves, Frank Gehry, made nomination essays as well. And in 2014, they awarded Julia Morgan posthumously the gold medal. It was one of their few posthumous selections, and it was the first woman to ever receive that honor in more than 100 years. So I think that really made a difference as far as putting her on the stage of international appreciation, which has been long overdue.
Gordon, you had something to say?
Yeah. I look at this in the perspective of perhaps the last 30 years. I was for a long time the director of the art gallery at Loyola Marymount University in LA. And a number of women artists began approaching me because they saw my gallery as a venue to recognize women artists who in the early 90s were still not getting sufficiently recognized. And so I always made that a large part of my programming and education, and subsequently after leaving LMU as well. And I'm happy to say that as we turned the century, there was a building momentum to recognize women in the visual arts and architecture, and to give them more parity in the art historical record. So that's the main contribution Victoria and I think have made, and others who have seen a larger panorama of art and architectural history than the previously restricted one, which was more limited to those heroic white guys.
Victoria, do you have any last things you want to mention or talk about here?
When William Randolph Hearst died at the age of 88 in 1951, Julia apparently said to her family, "Of course, Hearst Castle is just temporary for his use. The country needs museums of architecture, not just places where you show paintings and statues." And actually, the Hearst Corporation and family offered the castle as a gift to the University of California. That had been WR's wishes. They turned it down as prohibitively expensive, and that's how it became a California State Park. It opened on the 2nd of June of 1958, but the year before, Life magazine did a cover story, 14 pages, with the Neptune pool on the cover, all about San Simeon, photographs and essays, and Julia Morgan's name was never mentioned. And it's shocking to think of that, and it continued through the 60s. She was completely ignored. Joan Didion wrote a whole essay called Return to Xanadu about nothing but San Simeon and its architectural impact. Julia Morgan's name was never mentioned in 1966. So you can see there's been a big change, but there's a long way to go. And it's a pleasure to be part of this process to bring people's attention to what an extraordinary artist she was.
Well, again, thank you both so much for this.
Thank you, Ben.
Gordon Fugley is the author of Julia Morgan, The Road to San Simeon, Visionary Architect of the California Renaissance. And Victoria Kastner, the author of Julia Morgan, An Intimate Biography of the Trailblazing Architect. Both books were published this year. Santa Barbara's annual county fair returned this year after 2 years of pandemic delays. KCBX intern Ashley Rush has more.
You're in the starting gate. All the tickets are in. Let's hear a big cheer for your favorite color. Hello, folks.
Santa Barbara's annual county fair returned this year after 2 years of pandemic delays. Cook's Pig Races drew a crowd near the plaza entrance, where four miniature potbelly pigs raced around a half track.
And in the round, we've got Red Roaster, who's here for Red.
The theme this year was a salute to agriculture, highlighting Santa Barbara County's rural and agricultural past and present.
So our theme this year is a salute to agriculture. What we saw in this two-year hiatus, more so than anything else, was how important agriculture is to our community and to our survival.
That's Rebecca Barks, Santa Maria Fair Park Public Relations Coordinator. We met at the auction barn that hosts the Junior Livestock Program.
With that, this Junior Livestock Auction, you have 5 days of these kids just really showing off what they've done with the last 3, 6, 9 months of their project, and it ends today with our livestock auction, where those animals are put up for sale and sold, and hopefully for a profit.
The county fair shifted to virtual auctions in 2020 and 2021 because of the pandemic. Those events were on a much smaller scale.
For us, we've only ever not been a fair for two times, World War II and COVID.
This year, nearly 600 elementary through high school students from across Santa Barbara County participated in the Junior Livestock Auction. Most of them joined through agricultural programs at local high schools, known as 4-H and FFA, or Future Farmers of America. 17-year-old Sadie Vino has been showing hogs at the fair for the past 9 years. Sadie's a senior at Napomo High School.
When COVID hit, I got insanely more competitive, so I started to do jackpot shows all across the state of California and the western United States, and I just done good ever since then, and I want to keep doing it.
Kylie Clement is the president of Cinco Campanas 4-H, a youth development program in Santa Maria. This is the 17-year-old's last year showing at the fair.
Oh, there's definitely a lot less people, but it is more calm. It is definitely what I think fair should be. We are working together. There's a lot more community.
This year's Salute to Agriculture theme was especially meaningful to Kylie, she says.
So I come from an agriculture family, and for me that meant dedicating this year to my grandfather, who was an ag teacher at Rigetti and Lompoc. His name was Del Clement, and he definitely left a lot for me to look up to.
However, not everyone supports the county fair's livestock auction. Outside the main entrance on Saturday afternoon, several protesters lined up with signs reading, quote, 4-H and FFA abuse kids and animals, end quote. That's referring to the Junior Livestock Program where students raise animals for sale. And while the fair celebrates this program, animal rights demonstrators showed up with a different perspective.
We are here today to protest 4-H and FFA programs for sending animals to slaughter.
Protester Zoe Rosenberg founded Happy Hen Sanctuary in San Luis Obispo when she was just 11 years old. Rosenberg says she takes issue with the fact that most livestock here go directly to slaughter after the show.
We believe that these programs are really desensitizing children to violence towards animals and kind of teaching these children to exchange the lives of their animal friends for money. And it's just really not the lesson that we want kids to learn.
But Rosenberg also said she appreciated the several fairgoers who took the time to speak with her. In an email to KCBX News, CEO of the Santa Maria Fair Park, Caitlin Miller, defended the fair's practices, saying all processing after the fair is done locally. She called the county fair, quote, the most exciting and culminating period highlighting kids' earnest efforts at animal care and husbandry. Rebecca Bark said she expects the fair to be bigger and better next year.
We've got one in under our belt, so the experience of knowing how we can do it next year and bring it again back to the community, because we want them to come here. We're their local fairgrounds.
You can find more information about the county fair at santamariafairpark.com. More information about Happy Hen Sanctuary is available at happyhen.org. For KCBX News, I'm Ashley Rush.
This story was produced by KCBX interns Ashley Rush and Christina McDermott. Until 1947, California had segregated schools for Mexican-American children in some agricultural parts of the state, including in Santa Barbara County. And now, on the 75th anniversary of desegregation, an organization in Carpinteria plans to create murals as a visual testimony to the students of Aliso School and the local Latinx community.
102-year-old Josephine Villegas was born and raised in the small city of Carpinteria, southeast of Santa Barbara. She attended Aliso School, a segregated elementary school for Mexican-American students, and her story is captured on film as part of the Carpinteria Latinx Arts Project.
We were allowed to go to school half a day, only in the morning, and then by noontime, my mother used to pick us up. And we went and picked walnuts the rest of the afternoon.
The project is co-founded by longtime Carpinteria resident Suzanne Requejo. She says 75 years ago, the landmark case Mendez v. Westminster banned school segregation in California. Aliso School integrated in 1947.
Both of my parents, all their siblings, all attended Aliso School. Although they were American-born, they still were required to attend the segregated school.
Requejo says the high school was already integrated. But for Latinx students, the expectation was not for them to get a good education, but for them to pick fruit in the nearby lemon orchards. This is a clip from Benito Tony Villegas remembering a conversation he had with the high school administrator in Carpinteria.
I got my work here. I want to graduate. I don't care if I graduate with my class, even if I graduate with the class behind me, but I got to graduate. And he looked at me and he goes, Tony, who's going to pick the lemons?
Requejo, who works in education, says it's heartbreaking for her to think about the lost academic opportunities for so many students. She says the new murals will include this painful history, but in a way that is healing and uplifting for the whole community.
Carpinteria has a very rich history, stemming from the Chumash. And if we can include all of these cultures in our murals, I think that people will have a better sense of pride in the community, more of a sense of connection to our community.
Co-founder and Carpinteria resident Leslie Westbrook says she was shocked to learn that Aliso School was segregated for many years. She says the history isn't widely known. Westbrook says the goal for the Latinx Arts Project is to create three murals representing past, present, and future.
Knowing that our community is 50% Latino and much higher percentages in the schools, and that murals are such a wonderful output of the Mexican and Mexican-American community, I felt that we should create something here in town that not only celebrated that, but that was created by Latino artists, hopefully.
Santa Barbara filmmaker Brent Weinbrenner produced the video to introduce the mural project at Aliso School in June. The film includes interviews with a handful of students who attended the school during segregation or shortly thereafter.
I expected, given the nature of the subject, you know, segregation of the school, that there would be some bitterness or resentment or some angst about their childhoods, and there wasn't.
Weinbrenner says the people in the film are about 80 to 102 years old and eager to share stories, especially about their children. He says the 13-minute documentary has generated lots of interest because the history is important for audiences beyond Carpinteria. The Latinx Art Project's search for available space is underway, and they expect to issue a call for artists soon. You can hear more about the mural project and see the film at the next Latinx Arts Project event on July 30th. More information is at latinxartsproject.org. For KCBX, I'm Beth Thornton.
The KCBX Arts Beat is made possible by a grant from the Shanbrom Family Foundation. And finally, Father Ian is tasting flavored beers and sharing his experiences on playing with food.
This is KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. I'm Father Ian Dellinger, and I'm playing with food. What you hear in the background is the sound of beer being made. Actually, you're hearing the sound of beer being canned. Beer has been around for a long time, about 13,000 years. It's since been refined into stouts, pale ales, hefeweizens, lagers, and other classic styles. But recently, the craft beer explosion has led to some pretty interesting flavors. I first encountered flavored beers at beer festivals in Greater Manchester in the UK, where the Belgian fruited beers became very popular in the early 2000s. It was then that I came up with a rule, for only myself of course, don't put stuff in my beer. Since then, I've discovered milk stouts, orange wheat, habanero IPA, chocolate stouts, and more. Not too long ago, my rule was challenged by a local brewer. Central Coast Brewing was showcasing their peanut butter stout, so I met up with George and Matthew to find out how on earth a peanut butter stout is made, and why.
George Peterson, Central Coast Brewing president and founder.
Matthew Suchek, Central Coast Brewing brewer.
Okay, so we're in a brewery. You and I were at an event where you had your truck. There were four beers and only one of them was normal.
Yeah, normal, wow. We were at a chamber mixer, and our truck has four taps on the side of it, and that day we had Terrifico, which is a Mexican lager with sea salt and lime, so that's pretty normal. Then we had Lucky Day, which is very normal. I would say the iconic West Coast IPA, and then a Hazy IPA. The last beer, which is not traditional, is a peanut butter stout. So that's probably the one that is the most unique of those four beers we were pouring that day. And was kind of a one of, honestly, when it started, has become so popular mostly because of the package to begin with. And then the package drags you back into the beer and the beer is really good. And so now it's a reoccurring package purchase. And it's also a marketing agreement with Skippy. And we're talking about a stout in July. That is not when that beer should be popular. And we are literally out of it again in the middle of July. And we should have been out of it in September. It doesn't do as well in tap form as it does in can form. And that's the complete opposite of all of the rest of our beers. All the rest of our beers have a tap presence with a can back. The can of peanut butter supports the tap and the brand. Completely opposite of the other 17 beers in our portfolio. Most people, when they go to a bar, want draft. Flavored beers typically don't do as well in the wild. They do really well at tap rooms and at the source because then we can kind of showcase it, we can talk about it. But when you put them out there with the tap wall of 30 or 40 beers, it's going to be IPA, Kolsch, Pilsner, blah, 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 you know, some sort of core rotating speed selling beer. And then down here on the right is going to be the double hopped triple IPA and the peanut butter beer and a triple hazy and maybe a sour. Unique to CCB and Central Coast Brewing, we have a raspberry sunrise, which is a kettle sour that pairs very well with the peanut butter beer. We call that a PB&J. Two unique styles, both of them as a style should be very underperforming. They should be portfolio fillers. Nobody would ever pro forma a beer portfolio and say that more than 5% or 10% of your portfolio is going to be these unique styles. Not the case. Raspberry sells out as soon as it's done peanut butter sells out almost the day the cans hit, and put them together at a party, and they're just the little dance couple because they love each other and it's so much fun. It happened at a wedding. That's how that branding started. Was we had the two on tap. We had raspberry and peanut butter on tap. And one of the bridesmaids said, well, I'm going to make a peanut butter and jelly because that just sounds fun. And Kelly and I took it and ran with it.
Did she mix them together or drink them side by side?
No, you mix them together. You literally put, and it's good. It really is. It's a really dynamic flavor. We'll try one little later.
Okay, because I don't believe you at all. Do you just make some beer and just throw some peanut butter in at the end?
No. I'm going to defer that one to Matt.
Okay.
We actually use a peanut extract in the beer. And Skippy. There's a little bit of Skippy in every batch. Using just raw peanut butter alone isn't going to give you that pop of flavor that you're usually looking for when you have a flavored beer like this. And so using a peanut extract, it really makes the flavor stand out in the beer. You're not getting just like this thick, hazy, muddied mess with all this peanut butter in it. So you can still have a really nice, clean beer, but the flavor comes through in a nice, strong profile. There's certain flavors that are kind of hard to harness. Some are much easier, like raspberry, very potent flavor, right? But strawberry, normally you have to add a little bit of extract in there, even if you are using like a strawberry puree, just to kind of help it pop. That's how we achieve the flavor in the peanut butter, and that's happening after fermentation is complete, after we've dumped all the yeast out of it, and we're going to start clarifying and carbonating the beer, and that's when that would be added in.
This is KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. I'm Father Ian, learning about flavored beers. George and Matthew at Central Coast Brewing in San Luis Obispo have described how it's made. I've always avoided the flavored beers. One of my rules is don't put shit in my beer. The first beer I drank that was flavored was the one that is flavored with local tortilla chips because somebody gave me a can. And then the second one I tasted was the one with the peanut butter at that event. So I've been avoiding them. So how long have these flavored beers been around?
Well, the Belgians as a whole have done stuff to their beer since, biblically speaking, because it wasn't just beer. It was food. So they were using local berries, local fruits, anything local that they could get their hands on. You know, the fermentation acts as a safety valve. Especially if the water's iffy, which, you know, centuries ago, you know, water was pretty iffy. So the boiling process, the yeast process, the whole fermentation process as a whole helps to safety valve your food source a lot. So having extra sugar, chocolate, peanut butter, raspberry, you know, so an oatmeal stout is a beer with shit in it because it's got oatmeal in it. And the oatmeal's the thickener. The oatmeal gives it head retention, makes it a much better beer on nitro.
I take that back. I did like a particular oatmeal stout from Yorkshire, which we get here, and it's actually harder to get in Britain because you have to be in Yorkshire to get it.
Yorkshire, yeah. Even the ESBs had molasses in them. Fruited beers, I think, traditionally have been popular, very popular in, you know, Western Europe. Belgium is its own little game there. But, you know, France has always had French versions and the strawberries and the lullaberries and things like that. Domestically speaking, I'd say most of the fruit stuff that you've ever seen here has been the shandy, the light summer beer type of thing where, you know, Yuling and their lemon shandy. Starts probably on the East Coast. The one that comes to mind on the West Coast is the Pyramid Apricot, which was groundbreaking when it came out in the 90s. And it tasted like an apricot basket of jam. I mean, it was amazing. It was a really amazing, you know, that bright orange and cloudy in the head space. And, you know, that had a little tinge of orange on the space and on all the foam. It was amazing beer. But again, mass produced to their level and mass produced at our level and then down to the one keg brewery guy. What's the difference between a loaf of sourdough bread from Oral Wheat and something from Back Porch Brewery or, you know, Bike Bread? Handcrafted, hand-touched, lots of variables, lots of seasonality, lots of water table problems or pluses. That's the difference between a handcrafted loaf of bread and, you know, bread off of a stack of two truckloads worth. That's what we do. So when you say fruited beers as an aggregate, where'd the fruit come from? What kind of fruit did they use? How much fruit did they use? Our raspberry beer has, 48?
So, yeah, it was a couple hundred pounds of raspberry puree.
It was probably a small truckload of raspberries to smash down to that level of raspberry that's in that one tank of one batch of our raspberry beer.
When I was doing my apricot segment, I was out in Sea Canyon. Then this guy shows up with his truck and we help load his truck, and he's like, I'm taking him to this brewery in Berkeley.
Pyramid.
Ah, okay.
No longer there, unfortunately.
You have these different flavored beers, and you corrected me. I have tasted, like, oatmeal stout. What flavored beers do you have available right now?
We have the Trifico with the lime and the sea salt. The same beer in that portfolio, the base beer is a Helles Lager. So the Golden Glow Pale Lager is the same beer as Terrifico, but then the Terrifico has the additional fermentation and the lime and the sea salt. Raspberry, absolutely, with raspberries in it. Peanut butter with Skippy and peanut butter. A stout that we make when stouts are popular, which is in the winter, has oatmeal in it. We have done a milk stout with lactose. We have done a pastry party beer, which has coconut and vanilla and some chai extract in it. We do the black lager General Schwartz, and we do the black lager General Schwartz with coconut. So we take the same beer and just literally put toasted coconut right into the fermenter. Boxes of toasted coconut, and it has a very unique coconut flavor, very pleasing, like a coconut cream pie.
How long and how many batches does it take to balance out all of these flavors and make sure they work?
Some of them are first game. Wow, this is so easy. Look how easy this was. And other ones are 5 years, 3 years, 2 years sometimes to get truly the sweet spot, I guess. You know, like where the raspberry is. So the raspberry is a crop. Every year the raspberries change. And every year the raspberry color goes up, color goes down. This one right now looks like a rosé because there's very little color in the actual raspberries. The raspberries now are almost pink. 3 years ago when there was a really abundance of water where the raspberries were grown, they were that deep ruby red. Again, we're not making excuses for the different colors. We're actually playing towards it. Hey, this is the 2022 raspberry crop. It's more rosé looking. It tastes like raspberries. It just has that rosé look. Last year, it looked like this ruby. Oh, okay, great. So if you're a large corporate brewery, that type of variance isn't acceptable. You can't get away with it. You know, people are expecting SRM pink, you know, basically a color profile pink with a really narrow color band. I can go from a light pink, almost peach color over here to a dark ruby red in the same can, same beer, and not getting any trend.
So when you grow and you're on that big corporate national distribution level, that's when you end up putting in chemicals and additives. And
expectations override typically the creativity and the flexibility that we are kind of revel in. You know, if we don't want to make a beer because the raspberry is not good enough, we don't make it. And just tell everybody we're out of raspberries. Sorry.
You're listening to KCBX Public Radio for the Central Coast. I'm Father Ian, learning about the history of flavored beers. Central Coast Brewing produces a peanut butter stout and a raspberry beer, among others. Matthew the Brewer took me out to the brewing tanks to show me how it's done. You'll hear all the noises of beer making, especially the canning that was taking place that day.
So right now we're just running off from our lauter tun over into our boil kettle. So that's the wort that's being collected in the grant there. And you see the water being added on top. That's for our sparge. So that kills any enzyme production we had going during the mash. Also helps strip out all the extra sugars that are in the grain so that we can get a nice sugary wort so that we have a solid base to ferment off of. And once we get to about 20.5 barrels, then we're going to start boiling. And so it's going to boil at around 213 degrees. And that's what you're going to sanitize our wort. In this one, we don't have any hop additions in here, but this would normally be where you add some hops to create the IBU content in your beer. It breaks down the alpha acids in the hops during the boil. But in this beer in particular, we'll be adding the hops into the whirlpool, which is going to be adding more flavor and aroma to the beer.
Okay, so this is your base beer. At what point and where and how do you put stuff in it, like peanut butter and chocolate and milk and things that shouldn't be in beer?
Depends on the adjunct. So the base beer, just grain, that gives us the base sugars. So the base sugar is what the yeast will attack and play with and become alcohol. So without sugar, you won't get beer. The grant keeps extracting and extracting out of the grain more and more sugar until the grain is pretty much exhausted. Depending on what we're doing, so like a kettle sour, like raspberry, we put the raspberry in right in the fermentation.
Right towards the end of fermentation, so maybe about a week in or so. Once we see the gravity drop low enough, we kind of know, okay, there's not too much time left in fermentation. The yeast are going to start autolyzing out and dying. So we want to get the raspberry in so that they can consume some of the sugars from that fruit, and then it'll create the higher alcohol content that we're looking for in the beer, and it just rounds out the flavor a little bit more than just adding in a bunch of just like whole raspberry or something that isn't going to be broken down or eaten at all. Yeah, all the other stuff would usually just be either during fermentation or right at the end. Like we might do an extract or something, and that would happen once fermentation is complete. We've dumped all the yeast out of the fermentation vessel and we begin to start carbonating and clarifying the beer. That would be when we add in like, say, a lime extract or something like that. And so that's going to be done as we're mixing up the CO2, because then that helps just kind of spread it out throughout the whole beer. And so then we can kind of carb and get our adjunct in there at the same time, so it makes it a little bit more efficient.
And the CO2 helps like a carrier when you're trying to add flavors and add esters, flavors, and olfactory things, that the smell is what you're looking for. Maybe the overall taste isn't there, but that smell is what makes that, oh my God, you know, the peanut butter smell is what hits you first, then the peanut butter flavor. Without the smell, that beer would be one-dimensional.
So when you're adding these flavors that aren't typical in beers, it's knowing that fine balance when that particular additive won't disrupt the chemistry.
Totally. And that's the difference between a really good lime salt Mexican style beer and one that tastes like amusement park lime juice off of a snow cone. It's green, it looks like lime, but wow, pucker. And if you use the wrong salt, table salt, for instance, you don't get the salt taste. Table salt dissolves in whatever it's salting. So if you use sea salt, which is designed to be in solution in the ocean, it weathers the beer process much better.
So there's a lot of the process that goes into it that also makes a really big difference on how those flavors are going to interact with the beer.
So I've learned about flavored beer. I've seen it being made. How does it taste?
Well, let's try the Terrifico and the Peanut Butter Stout, because those are the ones on tap. So this is the Golden Gold. This is the base beer, right? Okay.
So it's a Helles Lager, which is a Munich-style Hells, which is a Hellenic style, which is unique to Germany. It's a very fruit-forward, sweet beer in the base. It would definitely be a summer beer for the Germans.
Let me taste it. Cheers. Very nice, clean, refreshing, quaffable summer beer. And then this is the Terrifico with the sea salt and lime. Yeah. Yeah, I can. The lime coats the tongue.
Comes through.
Yeah, and definitely comes through. Okay, so this is the peanut butter.
Yep.
Well, you can definitely smell the peanut butter as you put it up to your nose.
Yep. And if you close your nose, the beer tastes completely different.
Okay, I'm gonna try that. You're right. And then
when you breathe back in, it's like, whoa.
Yeah, the peanut butter was on the back of my throat. Yeah, it got up. Yeah. Wow. The nose is definitely peanut butter. The taste is more kind of stout with a
caramelized.
Roasted
peanut. It's definitely more the roasted caramel, chocolate, coffee almost. There's a residual bitterness. Typical stouts. We could make this more buttery and more milkish with lactose, but I don't think that's where we're headed. It's definitely a beer that the peanut is the forward focus. Then it's still a solid stout when you're done. That's what I think people enjoy about it. Is they're not there just for the peanut butter, but, oh, that's pretty good. Wow. I'll have another one. It amazes me how popular it is. It's really cool that people are willing to try something different and not be afraid of it.
I didn't actually get to taste the PB&J, the raspberry beer and the peanut butter beer mixed together, but I'd say what I did taste wasn't bad. I will probably stick to my rule in general, but I'm now more open to giving some of the more unique flavors and styles a try. There are so many craft beers on the Central Coast, whether it's a lager with salt and lime on a hot summer day or a peanut butter stout on a cold winter's night, there's something for everyone. I'm just waiting for the steak and potato stout, which would be a true liquid lunch. This is KCBX Public Radio for the Central Coast. I'm Father Ian, and I'm playing with food.
You've been listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. Gary Eyster composed our theme music. A special thanks to all our guests and contributors this week. I'm Carol Tangeman. Join us each Monday from 1 to 2 in the afternoon for more local stories. You can head to our website to learn more about what you heard today or to listen to past segments, kcbx.org.